On April 9th, 2008, the senior statesman of Virginia hosted Charlottesville area delegates David Toscano and Rob Bell. The two reviewed this year's General Assembly session and gave a preview of the upcoming veto session. Mike Ludgate serves as the moderator for the event.
But this is an annual event that we have sponsored, sort of a report card type thing from our delegates who slave away down in Richmond and the doing whatever it is they do down there. Some say productive, some say not. We'll judge that after we get the report, I guess. But today we have our two delegates from this region, a delegate Rob Bell, who is a graduate of UVA, both undergrad and the law school. And I won't run through all of their resumes because I'm sure that you've been aware of who they are and what their backgrounds are. But he's been in the legislature for several years now and has accumulated some stars, if you will, for legislation regarding such things as pedophilia and some of those situations. And he is a Republican, for those who must know. And then we have on the Democratic side, Delegate David Toscano, who has been also an attorney here in town. And I went to Syracuse University, and he went to Colgate. And a long time ago, we used to be arch rivals. And in fact, I went to the last football game that Colgate and Syracuse played, and we beat them 68-0. And they said, time out, that's enough. So I just like to rub that in a little bit. But in any event, Delegate Toscano has been involved in city government, in serving in the city council and many other functionary roles in the city government. Perhaps one might say following the path of Mitch Vanieres, who was one of our esteemed members who passed away recently. So we've flipped the coin, and they're going to give us about a 10-minute, 15-minute. We're not going to hold them too closely to it because we have time here. So whatever time it takes, they'll give us a little report on what their activities were. Maybe they'll give us some insight into this transportation thing. Who knows? One of the great secrets. But anyway, David Toscano is going to be the leadoff man on this order. David? Oh, pardon me. Excuse me. One moment, please. Let me remind you that we take questions at the end, but the questions must be written out on a card. You will find cards in the back if you have not received one or if you need one. Perhaps if you hold up your hand, somebody will be able to get around to you and bring you one. But write so I can read it, please, and be brief, and we'll take those questions at the conclusion of their presentations. Excuse me. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. It wasn't on before, and then all of a sudden I saw a light go on, and it must have been on. Thank you very much for having us. It's a great pleasure to be here. This is the first of a series of what they might call the Rob and David Roadshow. After the session is over, we start the a whole series of these. If you miss us today, of course, you could catch us at the chalkboard down on the mall sometime during the summer. We'll be speaking probably for the Charlottesville Albemarle Bar Association. Who knows who else will have us along the way. But it's always nice to come to these events and share with you my perspective on what went on, to hear from you with your concerns about what didn't go on or should have gone on and what should go on in the future, and actually to kind of exchange views with Rob, because we see eye to eye on some things and don't see eye to eye on a lot of things, and so we get a chance to go back and forth a little bit and get some insight into how various folks think about various issues in the General Assembly. Marvin, I hope you checked to make sure that I paid my dues. You know, it would be kind of a shame that if I showed up and hadn't paid my dues. I think I've been paying them. Okay, that's good. That's good. You know, we really do miss Mitch. He used to come to all of these events and used to give us a hard time, usually with some pointed question or another. So hopefully one of you will pick up that mantle, or several of you will pick up the mantle and ask the difficult questions, because we really can't do our job unless folks are telling us what they think. It's been a great honor to represent you. I've been down in Richmond now for 3 years, and I'm learning more every day. And we did a lot of good things this last session, and a lot of things we didn't get done or weren't done so well. The good news is that we got a budget. That's the most important thing we do in the first of the successive year sessions. For those of you who don't know, we have a biennium budget. That means we pass a budget for 2 years. The budget gets passed during the long session, what they call it, which is the 60-day session that we're down there for 60 days. And then the next year we come back, that'll be next year, for 45 days to tweak the budget and pass a whole series of bills as well. So the good news, we got a budget, and that budget is pretty good in a number of areas. One of the most important areas from my point of view is we were able to, what they call, re-benchmark the standards of quality for education. What that means is making sure that school divisions across the Commonwealth are adequately compensated so that they can provide the services to make our kids as well educated as we can get them so they can compete in the world economy when they finish school. That includes making providing the pay raises for teachers so that we can keep the best and the brightest in our classrooms where all the magic happens for these youngsters. So we got a budget and it includes the re-benchmarking for educational funding. That budget is also very good in the area of mental health. We increased the budget substantially over what was passed 2 years ago for mental health in light of the Virginia Tech tragedy. And we'll talk a lot more about that later. Delegate Bell and I served on the mental health subcommittee that looked at all of the mental health law and tried to put in some reforms. Delegate Bell chaired the committee, and I can tell you he did a tremendous job and spent a lot of time and energy in making sure that we got the best product out to the General Assembly, and we got a lot of those bills passed. Beyond mental health, there's a lot of new money for higher education, which is really important to us around here with the University of Virginia and with Piedmont Virginia Community College. So the good news is we got a budget. Another piece of good news is we got rid of the abusive driver fees. Of course, there's a little bad news in that, too, because when we got rid of the abusive driver fees, it knocked a $60 million a year hole in the transportation budget that has not yet been filled. And we'll probably talk about that in a little more detail a little bit later. Other good news, again, has to do with the mental health law reform. We got some pretty good reforms in place, and we're going to see how those operate over time. The big challenges that remain, we still have to get a bond package for the funding of capital improvements for higher education and for some mental health facilities. We think we're going to be going back on April 23rd. We'll have a bond package that we can pass that will put some money in the pipeline to help prime the economic pump of our areas that will have capital improvements made for higher education and mental health facilities. But of course, the big challenge, the looming issue still remains transportation. It was when I got down there 3 years ago, it was last year, it was this year, and it's going to continue, I think, for several years to come. We don't have an easy fix. Some of it requires changes in the way we do our land use planning in Virginia. Some of it requires some different ways of thinking about how we develop in Virginia. And some of it, frankly, requires money that nobody has figured out where to find yet. So that challenge will be on our plate. It will continue to be on our plate. At this point, you know, I want to turn it over to my colleague, and so we can leave a lot of time for questions and exchanges on issues. And thank you very much again for asking me.
I'd like to echo what Dave said about thanking you for coming. This was my very first debate I ever came to was in this room. And I think they had the whole room open up, and it was about 7 years ago, probably closer to 8 years by now, and I was terrified. Just terrified. And this is, especially not being an election year, this is a little more sort of, I'm less nervous. I'm not a public speaker, but it's nice to come back. It's nice to see you again. This is, I represent the old Thomas Jefferson district. It's the 58th district of the House, and way back in the day, Thomas Jefferson had my seat. It's always an honor to do anything in a public setting in Thomas Jefferson's old seat. The area I represent is Albemarle County, Greene, Fluvanna, and the Barboursville part of Orange. If you live in the city, or if you live more west of town, or real close to the city, you're probably one of Dave's constituents. The job, as I think was mentioned earlier, is a part-time job, and that has the disadvantage that we only have 60 days to get our work done, and so you're going to hear that some of the things just didn't, we couldn't work it out and we didn't get them finished. I think the benefit is that with a real deadline, you'll see that it really pushes us, I think, when we're close to go ahead and finish a job, to make the compromise to get something finished. And then the other theory is that by coming home, we realize what it's like to live under our own laws. And so if you live in Richmond, if you work in Richmond for 60 days, you'll see that we never open our own doors, and no one ever calls us anything but delegate, and people take us out to dinner, and every joke is funny, and every suit is beautiful. And you come home, and suddenly I'm not as funny as I used to be, or as good-looking, or as tall. And it helps us maintain perspective. It's actually a very healthy thing for us to come home and have to do our own laundry or whatever else that you do around the house that isn't so grandiose as being in Richmond. So I think that on balance, most of us decide this isn't a good system, but it's the best anybody can come up with to balance being legislators with trying to maintain a real life. I've come before you, I think, every year after the session, and usually I have a laundry list of little bills that I worked on. And as I have become more senior, my responsibilities have changed. And so I still have a couple of little bills, and I'll tell you about them. But this year, instead of having sort of broad, narrow work, I had very deep and focused work on one thing, and that's on the mental health bills that Dave talked about. Everybody knows that April 16th of last year, there was a worldwide, hopefully once-in-a-century tragedy at Virginia Tech. And after that happened, it encouraged us to go back and look at the mental health laws in a very comprehensive way, not just to try and fix what happened at Tech, but also to use this as an opportunity to maybe make sure that we fix other things while we're fixing that. Now, there's what happens in Richmond is there's a handful of delegates on any issue that work on it year after year. And so, by happenstance, Dave and I have been working on mental health for our entire tenure there. But everybody else is worried about other things. And so what happens when something like Virginia Tech comes up is those of us who've been sort of plugging away say, gosh, here are some ideas. Y'all weren't very interested. They weren't going to put the money in. How about we try them? And so that's what happened. There were about 60 bills submitted. Dave had some. I had some. And then I was fortunate enough to be appointed to be the chairman of the committee that went through them. And our goal was to, of course, figure out the best way to do each of these issues and then make them into just a handful of bills so they could pass. And the issues are very complicated. And I'll just sort of walk you through briefly, and then if you have more questions, we can talk further. But the issue is when someone doesn't want to get mental health care, they say, I don't want to go. Under what circumstances can we make them go? And the reason is, of course, at Virginia Tech, the young man, Mr. Cho, was identified as someone with very severe mental disabilities, real trouble. He actually was brought before a judge. The judge actually ordered him into treatment. He said, Mr. Cho, I don't care if you want to go or not. You have to go. And then he was never brought into the system. Nobody ever followed up. He never went. And many months later, of course, shot up Virginia Tech, killed 31 people. It's a horrible thing. What really made it sad was that not only was he mentally ill, but we had him identified. I think, I've said this many times, I really do think that as a Commonwealth, we bear responsibility in some ways because it's not that he was sick or not that he was dangerous. There are lots of people that fit those categories, but here we had identified him as someone we needed to keep an eye on, and we just didn't do it. So the bills that came up had many parts. The first part was we said, let's make it slightly easier for you to have someone involuntarily committed than the current law. Virginia was one of only four states that said it had to be imminent danger, and what that means is just about to do something awful. That's current law. And every other state except for four had moved toward a broader standard to bring someone in. We've decided, looking at what's working in other states, that we're going to do that too. So instead of it being just about to do something awful, we said serious bodily harm in the near future. That still sounds pretty just about to do something awful, but it's still broader than what we had. The second thing is we said that the community service boards will have to go to the meetings. Now that sounds obvious, but the community service boards, one reason that Mr. Cho fell between the cracks is because they didn't go to the hearing, they didn't know he was one of their people, and they never followed through with him. The third thing is we said you're going to have to bring him back to the judge if they don't follow what the doctor tells them to do. Again, that may sound obvious. That's not what happened in Mr. Cho's case. And when we looked at it, it turns out that there are many people that was not happening for. Now, the good news is this was a fairly common problem, but most of the time when something awful happened, it wasn't a murder. It was just the person disappeared. It was dangerous primarily to themselves rather than other people. Even that's something I think we should worry about. And so the tension in the mental health laws, we're trying to balance public safety, keeping people safe, with therapy, making people better, with not forcing someone into treatment if they don't want it, unless they're dangerous. And that was the balancing act. And we had, gosh, about 7 long committee hearings. We heard from doctors. We heard from what they call consumers, which are people who are mentally ill. We heard from a bunch of parents and family members who said, gosh, for the last, we had one father who said he had tracked his son up and down the East Coast. His son had serious mental illness. His son would have a problem. His son would be arrested. The dad would bail him out. The dad would get him help. The son would be released. The son would get in trouble. And we had one husband of a wife say he had done dozens of these. That doesn't sound like a good way to make the system work. And so hearing all of that and trying to balance all of the goals, we came up with a bill, and I'm very, very happy with the bill. It was a true bipartisan, in 7 years, it's the biggest bipartisan effort I've ever been a part of. Democrats, Republicans, House, Senate, the final compromise was worked out at a table with the governor's people on one side, me and Vivian Watts, who's a Democratic delegate, on the other side, just working through the issues one by one. I'm happy to say this is, 2 hours ago, this is the pen that Governor Kaine used to sign the bill. I literally came straight from the governor's office, and these are 3 bills that he signed. It's very exciting to sort of see something good come of that terrible, terrible tragedy. We did work directly on some university issues that will affect us in Charlottesville, although obviously I think most of us in this room are not students anymore, but the issues include, when can you tell someone's parents that they're having real trouble? The obvious answer would be always, and then the students and the doctors told us, well, if you say that, we always tell the parents, and the students won't come to us, because most students come voluntarily. So we tried to balance and say, we'll only tell the parents if the kid is in real danger. That was we worked out some language to say that's when you tell the parents. There were issues of when should the universities have access to student records, like if a high school student like Cho comes in with serious mental illness, should the universities have access to that? We decided that they should. And we did a bunch of other things with regards to university safety issues as part of the review of Virginia Tech. And our hope is that we fixed not just what happened at Tech, but we used this year as an opportunity to fix some of these other problems that we've had for a long time. So I'll be happy to talk. Dave is also involved in the committee at every step of the way. He might have a different perspective of some of these bills. I'm happy to talk about mental health as much as anybody wants to talk. We did do a number of other smaller bills that I had and that other people had. My small bills included something called transferable development rights. It's a way to try to manage growth without taking away property rights. I'll talk about that if anybody's interested. We had a bill brought about by a media study. The newspapers did a study of background checks for teachers and found that they're not being done very well. And so I had a bill that would require significant new background checks for teachers before they get hired. There's some other smaller issues I'm happy to talk about. And then the General Assembly, of course, had a number of issues it addressed that neither Dave nor I were the patrons for. These included things like animal fighting, payday lending, and of course the budget. So I'm happy to take any questions you might have, and rather than talk a whole lot further, I'll just take your questions. In the back, if you're too shy to ask a question but really want to give me some feedback, I have a feedback card. It's got my address on there and a postcard. Please just send it in. I'd be happy to hear from you. And again, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much. If people have cards, if you just hold them up, somebody will come around and collect them. If you need a card, raise your hand also, and we'll pass them along. I have one question here, and the question is, and then you may want to know a little more depth on the basis of the question, but the question is, would you support and or propose legislation requiring Virginia medical students to include a course in geriatrics in their regular curricula? Evidently, according to the background information that's given, that is required for pediatrics, but not geriatrics. And the writer, obviously, is asking because of the population growth in that elder group, should this be something that would be also required as pediatrics is required?
I mean, that's a very interesting question, and I think no one would deny the need for more geriatric physicians to be trained in the Commonwealth and in the country. Question is, how do you go about doing that? And I'd love to have some more information about what's required and what's not required, and before answering the question. I mean, in principle, you can embrace that and say yes, but I just don't know enough about what these hospitals and these teaching facilities require beyond pediatrics. So after this is over, if someone could come up and enlighten me, I'd appreciate it.
I would echo what Dave said. I don't think I know enough to have an informed answer. I know that obviously pediatricians are a common specialty and something that people do. I know that just from talking to people over at the medical center, more doctors are seeing geriatric medicine as a specialty rather than just as something you do in addition to your general practice. And I would think that let me just echo what Dave says. I'd like to hear more information about it to see if it's something we need to make a requirement or whether the medical schools think they can address it through their normal processes.
I'm sure the writer will get you additional information or fill in some background on it. Well, I'll be darned. We got a question about transportation. Never thought we'd do that. What are the options for funding, for finding transport?
I mean, there's no secrets here. I mean, the choices for finding transportation funding, or either you find it elsewhere in the budget, and as the budget grows, you either literally take it out of other programs or you take it out of the growth of the budget, or you raise taxes. I mean, those are the two choices. I'll answer. I'm sure there's going to be more questions.
Well, in theory, you can print money. In theory, you can print money and bond it. I mean, the problem is that if you float bonds, future generations end up picking up the tab. You're going to have to do some of both. And here's where there's wide variety of opinion, within the General Assembly, and no clear consensus. Because the first question to ask is, do we have a transportation funding issue? I think there's been a lot written about it, but I'm not even sure there's consensus about that. It would be my view that we have such a problem. If you understand how this works, the first dollars that get spent in transportation are required by law to be spent on maintenance. And what's happening in Virginia is more and more roads come online, and more cars are on the road, essentially destroying them over time and putting more pressure on bridges, etc. More and more money gets spent on maintenance. The end result is that less and less money is available for construction. Now, we don't have huge problems with construction in this area, although there are a few roads that I think ought to be built in this area, including the Meadow Creek Parkway, perhaps the Hillsdale extension. But we don't have the problems that they have in other places like Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads. That being said, you don't build roads with good looks. There is no free lunch, and so you got to figure out a way to fund it. My approach has been that if you have to raise money outside of the traditional budget, taking money from other parts of the budget, you do it with user fees, because if would you have a user fee, it's the fairest fee of all. Everybody who uses the road has to pay, and they pay whether they live in Maryland, North Carolina, or in Virginia. And they pay generally on the basis of how much of the roads that they use, either through some kind of gas tax, some kind of toll, or some kind of what they call congestive pricing operation. So I think that we first have to get to the issue of whether we do have a funding issue. I think we do. Until we get to the answer to that question, we can't get to the next question, which is, how do you fund it, given that there is a problem?
Well, the next question ties right into that. Will you support a rise in the gas tax to support transportation?
Am I going first? How do I?
You know my goal?
I would be very hesitant. So let me say, I would doubt I would support a gas tax increase. And I think it's important to recognize that transportation funding has not been flat. It has not been flat. I got the numbers here, and it's in the last 10 years, the VDOT budget has risen by 66%. It's risen by $1.6 billion of additional. That's on top of what we already had per year, or per biennium. And what has happened, and I think this is important to recognize, is that as fast as that has risen, maintenance costs have gone up faster, and the money that we have has been devoted to primary roads rather than secondary roads. Now, that's been a policy decision. We've decided we would rather have the money on 29 than on Hillsdale. We would rather have it on 250 than on Dickerson Road or some of the other projects that are in the six-year plan. We could certainly do a few things. We could certainly say, we would rather see some of that money in the secondary roads than in the primary roads. That would be a policy decision we could make. If we did that, a lot of these smaller roads would be built, but we might find less money for the bigger roads. The other part, and I think this is something that, in terms of the growth of the budget in my tenure, when I came in, it was $47 billion. It's now north of 74, it's about 78, and by the time this budget is over, it'll be about 80. Now, I'm sure, I'm looking around the room for anybody under 7 years old, we were all here when I got elected in 2001. We all remember what Virginia looked like. We had schools, we had roads, we had universities, we had jails. We were running this state on $47 billion a year. Since then, we have almost doubled the budget. Now, I'm not saying that we don't want to put some of that money into roads, that we decided that we've done very well by Medicaid, we've done very well by the university. Maybe next year becomes the roads year, just like this was the mental health year. But I would hope that given how much the budget has grown, from $47 billion to $78 billion, that within that additional $31 billion, we can find enough money for roads without going back to you all to increase taxes yet again through a gas tax. The last thing would be, please understand, at this point, the Transportation Trust Fund does not, in fact, act as a trust fund. We have tried several times to put a constitutional cap on it to say that when we get short in a bad year, we can't go in and get the money, but right now we can. And so if we raise your gas tax and put it in the trust fund, there is nothing to stop us from going in and getting that money. That's been one of the problems, is that we always treat transportation as the last thing on our list, and so by the time we get to it, the money's always gone. I would certainly, at least before we did anything else to raise new money, want to make sure that when we put that money into the trust fund, it sticks around for transportation and doesn't just become a piggy bank for us to use for everything else.
I think that first we have to try to get our arms around what we're talking about in terms of the money. Depending on who you talk to, our transportation needs of Virginia amount to about $1 or $2 billion additional each year. That's a tremendous amount of money. And I don't think we can overlook those estimates when we think about transportation. A couple of other interesting facts. Our vehicle miles in Virginia have expanded dramatically since 1986. There are many more people on the road, and they're driving more and more miles. That has the impact of essentially helping the roads disintegrate faster. There are more cars on the road. There are more people in Virginia. The maintenance costs have soared pretty dramatically. So you've got all those things you need to put into the mix. The gasoline tax in Virginia has not been increased since 1986 when Governor Belisle was in power and when they came up with a compromise to fix transportation at that point. That means that user fee, which has been funding transportation, essentially has been static for a long time. In fact, the purchasing power of that money has declined pretty dramatically, and the money is not coming in as fast because you have more fuel-efficient cars, and they're not paying as much in gas tax. I mean, it increases as an absolute number. The other thing I think we have to realize is that because the state isn't coming up with the money to help fund new roads and maintenance, the localities are doing it. Albemarle County is increasing its budget every year for road maintenance and construction. I don't know what it's now. It's maybe $3 million a year, something like that. But you can also look at other counties around the area. Augusta County is the same way. I don't know if Greene's doing it, but all of these localities are now putting money on the table out of your local tax dollars to fix their transportation problems. So when people tell you that Richmond is not raising taxes to help fund roads, well, that's sort of true and it's sort of not, because your taxes are being affected locally because Richmond is not picking up the slack. Again, it's my view that if you have to raise any fee or any tax to help build and maintain roads, it should be a gas tax. And so I'm more than willing to take a look at that. Give you perspective, 1 cent on the gas tax raises you somewhere between $50-60 million. That would replace what was lost with the repeal of the abusive driver fees.
Staying with transportation, discussion on transportation usually center on roads. Where do you stand on mass transportation?
Great question, and as someone who has a lot of experience in city politics and government. I can tell you that mass transportation has got to be part of the solution. We cannot pave our way out of these problems. I don't care if you live in an urban area or live in a rural area. You can't build every road that everybody wants. Some just don't make sense. And so you got to have a network wherever you are. Part of the network involves mass transportation. The good news out of the last budget year was that we put more money into mass transit than we ever had before. That's primarily urban mass transit. Beyond that, we've done some good things in rail. There's a dedicated source of revenue for rail improvements. And we're doing a lot of things around here that's going to improve rail service to Chicago, to Washington, south on the CSX and Norfolk Southern lines. So there are some good things that are occurring. Amtrak is now looking at another possible train that you can put on from Washington, D.C. that'll run through Charlottesville to Lynchburg on a daily basis. That may require some operating funds to come forward from the state to do it. We'll have to look very carefully at that. So a big piece of the puzzle is going to be filled with mass transit, and we need to make sure we have money in the budget to do that.
This relates a little bit to something Dave said about growth decisions also. It is very difficult for making mass transit work in parts of my district. If you look at Dyke, if you look at Swift Run, if you look at southern Fluvanna County, those are truly rural areas, and it is simply difficult to get the density of people to make bus systems work. I mean, you will run buses through and you won't have a lot of people. On the other hand, as Albemarle County has become much more of a suburban county, and as they use sort of packed-in growth as their model, it does make more and more sense to have mass transit. You can run mass transit by Forest Lakes. You can run mass transit through Woodbrook. You can run mass transit down in Mill Creek. Those are areas that are compact enough. It's not as good as apartments in terms of having people that might want to use buses, but at least they're there and you can make the system work. So I agree that this year's budget hopefully will encourage some of that.
Can we talk a little more about the question briefly? I want to raise something that Delegate Bell and I may be approached about at some point, because I want you all to be thinking about it and to give us your feedback. You may know that the city and the county have been discussing the possibility of creating a regional transportation authority and discussing the possibility of seeking some legislative authority to enact a local either gas tax or sales tax or some kind of dedicated source of revenue that will help fund transportation improvements in Charlottesville and Albemarle. If they were to ask for that, it would be Delegate Bell and myself that would have to hopefully cooperate to seek that legislative authority. And the earlier you all engage in that discussion and thinking about that issue, the better, because I'm sure we're not going to be interested in pushing legislation that we believe our constituents wouldn't want. So if you would keep your eye on that issue and let us know what you think about it, and talk to your city councilors and your supervisors about that issue. Let them know what you think about it. So as the process moves forward, they can have the benefit of as much public engagement as we can give them.
The next card said, TJPD, transportation, where will the money come from to make these improvements? So I assume that is what you were referring to, the creation of that type of
that actually entity is, and in fact, one of the big issues down in Richmond is to what extent we should permit regions to enact these authorities and what power should we give them. And it's a little bit different in Northern Virginia and in Hampton Roads, where you've got multi-jurisdictional authorities than you would have in Charlottesville, Albemarle. But the principle is still the same. It would require some state-enabling legislation to give the ability of these localities, especially in the area of taxing authority. That's something that I can tell you myself, and I imagine Delegate Bell feels the same way. If we don't feel there's broad public support for something like that, we're not going to advocate for it. Would that be fair, Rob?
It won't surprise anyone. I'm a little more concerned about this as a way to make policy. I mean, we passed, I didn't vote for it, but it passed, and I'm not complaining, but we passed the biggest tax increase in Virginia history in 2004. And the premise of those who supported it was that this would fix Virginia's tax issues, their structural imbalances, they said, for a generation. A generation. Our local tax bills have gone up and up. And I'm an Albemarle County resident. I own a duplex where we live up in Briarwood. We have seen our assessments go up dramatically. And over the last few years, our local tax bill has also gone up. Now, if these were somehow offset, in other words, as the state was cutting its taxes, the locality had to increase their taxes, so that one went up while the other went down, that would make sense. Or if they were cutting their taxes because we were sending them so much more money. And we are sending Albemarle County, and I've got the numbers here, I don't have it in front of me, a lot more money for education and other services than we did 2 years ago. So you might say, gosh, I'm paying more in taxes at the state level, but at least I'm getting it back at the local level. My concern has been over my tenure, and I'm not proud of this, I mean, I like to think of myself as a conservative, the state budget has increased from $47 billion to $78 billion. Meanwhile, so has the county budget gone up. And so my concern would be if we are going to create yet another taxing authority, yet another way for some level of government to raise your taxes, I'd want to have absolute certainty that that money was not, basically, if we're going to have a gas tax, we need to have a lower property tax. Or if we're going to have a sales tax, we need to have a lower something else tax. That's what I would want to look at if we're looking at this as it goes forward. Thank you.
Okay, I think we've ridden transportation, what a pun, to a fare thee well, so let's move on to another topic. What is, and this is for both of you, what is your position on bipartisan redistricting and why?
We've had this one before. I support bipartisan redistricting. I supported the bill that Senator Deeds proposed in the House. I was one of the people who had signed on the bill. You know, I've never thought that legislators should choose their own constituents. With the way it's done now, that essentially happens and can happen. You know, I'm in a unique position. You know, I've got a district that tends to trend Democratic, to say that mildly. So maybe nonpartisan redistricting shouldn't be a big issue to me. But my thinking is that when you have the legislators choosing their own constituents, what you do is make districts less competitive, and it makes it more difficult for the free flow of ideas to emerge in the course of a political campaign. And so I've supported the bill. For the first time, that bill got out of one body, passed out of the Senate, got killed in the House in a committee or a subcommittee. It's not going away, and maybe as the Democrats in the House increase their numbers, if they do, Republicans in the House will conclude that maybe it would be better to have a system that was more nonpartisan than to have the prospects of the Democrats taking over and then operating their own gerrymandering system the way they did for many, many years, to the neglect of the free flow of ideas.
I think that we have with a Democratic Senate, what is probably going to be a Republican House, although we have one more election and they don't, and then a governor of who knows, we might end up with a nonpartisan or bipartisan redistricting. I have not voted in the past for a system that would take it entirely away from us. I'm just uncomfortable with the idea of having a non-elected body have the ultimate say, but I've always welcomed, I mean, any input, any maps. We're at a stage now where, with very simple software, everyone in this room can design their own legislative maps and present it when we present the rest of them, but I'm not prepared to, at this point, cede all of that over to another group and say that we're going to stick with it, whatever their map looks like.
We had another card on that same topic, but I think we've pretty well covered the points that were raised in it. Let's move on to schools. What is the process used to provide support for the school systems?
I'll start. It's intricate, but it's actually not that complicated. Every locality has a number called the composite index. Now, this is a number you've probably never heard of, but everyone in education, every principal, every superintendent knows it by heart. And the composite index is how wealthy your community is and how much it should have to bear the cost of providing money for schools. So Albemarle County's composite index out of a dollar is about 63. Green County's is about 37, as I recall. And as you go toward the coal country, there are places as low as 18. And in Northern Virginia, there's as high as 80. Now, what that means is the state has designed something called the SOQs, and that's just the standards of quality, and it's what each school should have. How many teachers, how many assistant principals, how many classrooms, how many desks, computers, and whatnot. And the composite index says the state will pay that percentage of the SOQs. And so in Albemarle County, the state pays 37 cents on a dollar toward the SOQs. In Greene County, it pays almost the exact opposite. It pays 67. I think Charlottesville is just over the 50-50 line, as I recall. And so what you mean is richer localities are expected to pay more from their local budget than the poorer localities are. Now, one thing that does happen is some localities are so well off that they choose to buy things beyond the SOQs. They say, we don't want 1 per 22 as the student-teacher ratio. We want it to be 1 per 20. We want it to be 1 to 19. We want to have reading specialists. We want to have more art teachers. We want to have additional assistant principals. So Albemarle County, to pick an easy example, is wealthy enough that it actually provides significant funding beyond the SOQ. So Albemarle County pays much more than just the 63% of its funding. It provides, I forget the number they've told us. Other localities that are poor pretty much stick with the SOQ formula. And so that's where the school funding comes from. It's out of the general fund, which means there's no particular tax that goes directly to school funding. It's out of all of our taxes. Traditionally, we have paid for schools off the top. And if you look at over the last 10 years where the growth of our budget has been, it's almost entirely been Medicaid and schools. But in terms of the part that we really control, it's largely been schools. School construction, by the way, is handled entirely differently. We maintain bonds and enable the localities to build, but that's largely done through the localities.
It's interesting you get to learn all these euphemisms, terms, SOQs, SOLs, the benchmarking, composite index. You know, we'll have a quiz later on in the session. But I think Delegate Bell has kind of outlined how it works. You set a baseline, which is based on what's called a standards of quality. That means how many math teachers you have per number of students, how many teachers you have per number of students, whether you have nurses under the standards of quality. Whatever gets in the standards of quality is costed out. And based on the cost, then the composite index operates to come up with the amount of money that the state will send to the locality. And then what the locality does is potentially supplements that state money. They match it to some extent, and then they go beyond it. And in Albemarle and in Charlottesville and a lot of other places, they go beyond it. They go beyond it because they've got to usually pay teachers more money in order to get them to come to an area where it's very expensive to live. Or they go beyond it because they put nurses in every elementary school or certain categories of special ed teachers or phys ed teachers or, in the case of Charlottesville, orchestra or whatever it is that the community wants within reason. The public schools try to support with this extra money, and that comes out of your local tax dollars. So that's how it works. We had a bill in last session that would have helped try to help Albemarle County make up for a little problem the way the formula works, because Albemarle County and Charlottesville have a revenue sharing agreement whereby Albemarle sends money to Charlottesville in lieu of having Charlottesville having annexed land in Albemarle County back in the early 80s, but it's a lot of money. And that's never factored into the composite index. So Albemarle actually loses out a little bit on the state money that would otherwise come to it because of the way this works. We had a bill in there, but it didn't go anywhere. I think we'll continue to work on that. I also had a bill in that would have helped Charlottesville and Albemarle reward teachers at higher levels because of the higher cost of living here. It's called the cost to compete, and they get it from the state. This extra money is received from the state in some of the Northern Virginia counties where the cost of living is very high. Charlottesville and Albemarle have high cost of living. Why shouldn't they get this money? That bill didn't go anywhere either this year, primarily because of the budget issues. But we'll be back again.
Dave did better than me, but just to sort of summarize, it was a good question. you all, everybody in the state puts money in a pot, and the money flows to the poorer localities is the summary. And what it really means is that the wealthier localities subsidize the poorer localities through the state. That's the summary. And just the reason I smile talking about his bill, I'm very sorry. The money that Albemarle gives to Charlottesville directly is just not calculated into the formula. So whereas Albemarle looks really wealthy when they're calculating how much money Albemarle should get from the state, it's still well off, but it's not as wealthy as it seems because it's giving money to the city of Charlottesville. Now, I don't represent the city of Charlottesville, so I had an easy solution, which, of course, would be to take the money from the city and give it to the county. That was poorly received. So at this point, that issue has not passed. The good news is there's only one other locality that it would affect. Apparently, South Boston has some arrangement with some annexation issue just like ours. So it's not going to wreck the whole formula. The bad news is, because it only affects one other locality, that it's only Dave and I are fighting for it. We don't have 98 other votes for it. So we were told that in this budget cycle, the chance of it successfully passing is essentially zero. Hopefully, we can come back and look at it in future years.
Michael, can I ask a question of the audience? How many folks here lived here in 1981? Oh, a good crew. Well, those of you who lived here in 1981 will remember that the revenue sharing agreement was historic at the time, because I think it was the first jurisdictions in Virginia ever to do it. Prior to that, what would happen is these jurisdictions would have incredible and expensive fights on annexation, where cities and towns could annex county land. And so Charlottesville, at that point in time, entered into an agreement with Albemarle, whereby Charlottesville gave up the right to annex county land, probably all the way out to the Rivanna on 29. And now, if you can imagine the tax benefits that would have accrued to the city if that annexation had occurred, and what would happen if Albemarle County, if that annexation would have occurred and the development that would have gone into the rural areas, a whole host of other issues, you just can't imagine what that would be like. So what they came up with was a formula to share in the taxes that were derived from growth in the annexed area. Now, people, it's important for people to understand that, because it's not like Albemarle just gives the money to Charlottesville. This was an agreement that's probably served both localities pretty well over the course of time.
And this is directed at Delegate Bell. When complaints come to a teacher's attention that harassment and bullying being done, does the teacher react and take action?
I hope so. I assume this is related to the bill we had a couple of years ago. I don't know. I hope the person who wrote this has not had any personal experience, but usually interest in this derives from someone's child or maybe grandchild having trouble in school. The bill we had, let me underline this, many of our local schools already had these in place, so I'm not sure this was directed so much at our local schools but at other schools across the Commonwealth. We require each school to have a bullying prevention program in place, and what that should include, if it's done right, is a reporting mechanism for students who feel that they're being bullied. So either they're taught early on in the semester, or if it's grade school, is through their homeroom, who you talk to. Do you talk to the teacher? Do you talk to the principal? We included specific provisions to keep teachers out of trouble. We included provisions to say you will not be held liable if you break up a fight or if you get involved or if you make a report. Because there is some concern among teachers groups that, gosh, two kids are fighting. It's clear that one is bullying the other. I'd like to get involved, but I don't want to get sued. So one of the things we included was provisions for the teacher. And then the last part, this wasn't asked, but hopefully this would be part of the curriculum going forward. Dewey Cornell and Peter Sherris are the two UVA professors who are just geniuses about this. They just happen to live in our community. So if you lived in Oregon, you would still know about these guys. We happen to have them here. And what they have said is that the goal of all of these programs is to get in early and make the kids believe in it. Because what they've said, and I didn't think about this, but of course they've thought about it all their lives, the kids will find places where there are no adults around to do bad things if it's just the teachers and principals forcing it on them. And the goal is to try and get the kids to buy in. So if you can get the kids in kindergarten, first grade, second grade to say bullying is bad, bullying isn't cool, bullying isn't something you should do, then when the kids are by themselves, they will enforce it as well as having the teachers and adults do it. But the short version of the answer is I would hope so. They should. And if let me, in case the person had an experience where that didn't happen, I get calls from time to time just because of the bill. The next step would be to approach the principal. I would go in person. I wouldn't make a phone call. I would schedule an appointment, go in person. If you're not satisfied with that, I would set up an appointment with the superintendent. Go in person. Don't make a phone call. And if you're not happy with that, talk to your local school board or call me, and we'll do what we can. Thank you.
For both of you, Virginia is one of the only few states that do not reimburse dentists who provide dental care for adult Medicaid-eligible patients. Can this be changed?
I might be mistaken. I thought it was not that there's no reimbursement. It's just the rate is so low that most dentists find that it's not worth the, literally not worth the paperwork to fill it out. If that's mistaken, maybe someone can tell me.
Well,
same issue applies. I mean,
follow that logic then.
Right.
If they don't get enough money to bother to do it, yeah, then what can be done about that?
Right. That's a state. That is a nationwide issue. Go ahead, David. You want to?
Well, I mean, the easy question is you can always change that. And in fact, every year that we consider the budget, there's usually some change or proposed change in Medicaid reimbursements. And in fact, this year, if I'm not mistaken, there was some proposed changes in the governor's budget, and those were tweaked. And I can't remember if they were tweaked up or down, and maybe Rob remembers. But I believe the governor tried to increase the Medicaid reimbursement levels because they're abysmally low. And of course, again, here's another issue where, you know, everything has a cost, and you put it in the budget, and it increases the budget. And you know, if you want to fund something else out of the budget, well, do you stop with the increases in Medicaid reimbursement? You know, here are the people who are providing service to those who are most in need, who find it difficult to afford to buy the service themselves. Do you want to hurt those folks in order to build a road? So, you know, it's always a difficult question. The short answer is yes, we can always raise the rates. The question is to what level and what cost.
The lottery gives money to schools. Which schools receive the money, and for what is the money used for?
I think we're having a consultation up here. I mean, our sense is that it goes through the formula. It comes in. It goes out, although some of the money goes for school construction,
yeah,
and that does not go through the formula. But I don't have those figures on the top of my head.
I mean, it is by statute required that every dollar that the lottery raises goes to schools, that which doesn't go to administrative costs or payouts. The problem, and I think everybody remembers, the lottery is another example, like I was talking about the big tax increase. The lottery was supposed to fix everything. And in fact, for what it's worth, it is the money it has brought in has exceeded initial projections. So by no means has it been unsuccessful. It's been very successful at separating Virginians, North Carolinians, Marylanders from their money. And the money does go to the schools. But we have no rule that says you can't take the other money that the schools are getting and use it for other things. So I think that the school budgets go up so much every year. I mean, we are driving it at $1 billion this year. It was roughly the same amount 2 years ago. So it is certainly using up the several hundred million dollars that the lottery is raising. But it is not true that it has fixed the problem.
Okay, a new topic, payday loans. What is your stand on the payday loan process? Interest rates, that's the whole issue.
I was just, we passed a year ago, 2 years ago, so I guess it was not this session, but last, there was a big fight over payday lending. And what happened was a proponent, a supporter of payday lenders, had a bill, and on the floor, there was a what they call a floor amendment that changed it from a pro-payday lending bill to an anti-payday lending bill. And Dave and I both voted for that amendment. Now, that doesn't sound like, this sounds like inside baseball, but what I'm saying is that's very unusual. You know, the subcommittee has its hearings, the committee has its hearings, they come up with a big compromise, that bill is presented to us on the floor. Usually that's it. The bill sometimes fails, but usually that's the bill that is supported. In this case, sentiment about payday lending was so bad that a majority of delegates, including the two of us, voted for a floor amendment, and the guy whose bill it was, the patron, once the floor amendment passed, he said, I give up, I quit, I kill my own bill, because it no longer does what I wanted it to do. So this year, there was a consensus among people that wanted to reform the industry that it was time to rally around a single bill rather than have three or four ideas and have them argue against each other and have nothing pass, because if nothing passes, you've got no protections at all. You've got no reform at all. And so there was a final compromise bill that Dave and I both voted for, and I was going to read the provisions because I have them here. I thought there might be a question about this. It says, payday lending right now, as you know, is largely unregulated. With this bill, and this will be law as of July 1, payday lenders may charge a fee of not more than 20% of the amount of the loan proceeds. There's a $5 verification fee, and this is the part that people like. They don't like those two parts. The part they like is the annual rate shall not exceed 36%. And then there's some additional provisions about not having multiple loans, because what's happened is that people have gotten in trouble where they go in February, they get a loan to cover some emergency, and then something else happens, and come March, they get three more loans, and all of a sudden they're in a pretty dangerous cycle of increasing debts. That was the bill that passed. I don't know if this will settle the issue. It was certainly the conclusion of, 60 days of fighting and arguing and compromising. I certainly wasn't actively involved in that. I don't know if you were, Dave.
No, I wasn't actively involved in the fighting or the negotiating. I was actively involved in the supporting of a reform measure. I've voted for every single payday loan reform bill that's ever been, has ever hit the floor. There are a couple of things about this. One is trying to cap the interest rate. 2 years ago, we voted for a bill that capped the interest rate at 72%. Wow. Huge reform, right? But it was all that we could get at the time. This year, we rallied around 36%. Again, that's not a great number either, but it was a number that people could rally around, and the consumer groups, the anti-poverty groups, all agreed that at least that's the number we could work with. But beyond that, there are a couple of other major issues. One is the cycle of debt. Just putting the 36% cap does not deal with the cycle of debt. And what happens is what was happening is a lot of people were getting two or three of these loans, four or five of these loans all at one time, and they just couldn't pay them off in a way they could get out of debt. And with this new bill, we've got some prohibitions against how many loans you can have out at any particular time. Beyond that, I mean, I think there's got to be new models for addressing the problem of the subprime lender, the person who has a very difficult time, doesn't have a bank account. We've seen some new products develop over time, a couple that are going to be rolled out in this area that might help deal with the problem. But this is not a problem that's going away, because a lot of folks who are in desperate straits have a difficult time getting access to credit. The only place out there to this point had been the payday lenders. And they were taking advantage of the situation. We don't have a lot in our area, but you go down Newport News, Virginia Beach, it's a huge problem. This is not over by any means. The governor probably will not amend this bill, although there's a lot of pressure on him to do that. We're going to find out when we go back on April 23rd whether he did that, and then we'll have to decide how we feel about the governor's proposed amendments.
Just so everybody's clear, the payday lending industry is new. You might think, I don't remember this being around for a long time. And the reason is Virginia has usury laws. And there are reasons why banks don't run payday lending. And what happened was it 2002? At some point in the recent past, a change was made. A change was made to allow very high interest rates under very certain circumstances. And the patron of that bill is Delegate Harvey Morgan, and he is leading the charge against the payday lending. He said, look, when I did it, I did it with good intentions. I know that it was hard to get small loans. This seemed like a way to allow for small loans. The result has not been what I ever thought it would be. I now would like to basically repeal the law that I passed 6 years ago. That's why they're new. I think that obviously with the experience that we've had over the last few years, it's time for some additional reforms.
Going back to transportation, do you think that the Virginia General Assembly is receptive to private-funded toll roads?
Yes, we passed several laws to allow, there's the Public-Private Partnership Act, there's a separate, I forget what it stands for, the PPTA, Public-Private Transportation Act, but there have been several provisions to allow privately funded toll roads, and then also the new technology for public-funded toll roads. If you haven't driven some of these public toll roads in a long time with their hot passes, you haven't seen the new technology, and it just makes it much easier and efficient to collect tolls than having to pay someone to stand in a booth to take 50 cents, which obviously was, you end up spending a lot of the money that you raised just to collect the money.
Yeah, the answer is yes. People are very interested in it, and but it's not a solution. You can only use it in certain places, and it probably makes sense if you're going to build a new road. But you try to put them on a road that's already there, or sell an asset, and it's not all clear that it works very well. There's some conflicting evidence around the country in Texas and Indiana about how well these things work. I think it's going to have to be part of the solution, but it's not the silver bullet.
Sticking with transportation, you alluded to this in one of your other answers, but let's focus in on it a little bit more, if you will. How can we get more support for enlarging and improving rail service in Virginia?
And this will have to be my last question, because I have to do transportation, get to court by 3 o'clock. That's part of my other part of my many jobs. But no rail service between. We have a dedicated, as I said, we have a dedicated source of revenue. I think the tax on rental cars that kicks in money into the rail enhancement fund. And beyond that, there is general fund money in the budget. But again, rail is very expensive in terms of putting the capital in place to support the rail bed, to support the rolling stock. It's not cheap to run a railroad. And so there's going to have to be more money over time, and you got to be very selective where you put it. As Rob mentioned with mass transit, I think it's true with passenger rail. You know, it just doesn't work in some places, and we have to be realistic and hard-headed about it. I mean, it's nice. We love the trains, but they're expensive. The other thing we need to realize is, you know, every mode of transportation has some degree of public subsidy. We forget about that with roads. There's a lot of public money that's going into subsidized roads. And if we think about rail in the same way, then perhaps it doesn't seem as expensive to invest in the rolling stock and in the roadbed to make sure we've got a system that runs on time and gets more people on.
The Delegate Toscano's client is anxiously looking for him in the halls of justice. So we'll let him go at this point and express our appreciation for his coming today. But this great roadshow continues on, because we aren't through until 3 o'clock, and we have more questions. Why can't there be stiffer laws passed to get the mentally ill into treatment? It sounds as though the new law is little different than the old one that has caused so much trouble.
Two things. Let me start with the second. I think that the people in the system do not believe it is a minor change. In other words, that the people we're working with see this as a very significant change. The difficulty of only being able to intervene at the absolute last second has all sorts of bad effects, one of which is you miss. Sometimes you don't get it right. And there was a case, it wasn't Cho. In Virginia Tech, we got him. We identified him. But there's a case up in Fairfax where the family members brought their son in and said, he is very dangerous, he's talking about hurting people, and the magistrate said, I just don't see it, not enough. And he left and shot up the police station and killed two police officers. That's an instance where they weren't far enough out. We think that allowing it to be, and we argued the words in the near future, we talked about that from last June until our last five-hour meeting. Honest to God, we talked about it at our first meeting, every meeting thereafter, we kept going back to it. I'm being too detailed. The current law says it has to be imminent danger, just what it sounds like, imminent danger, just about to happen. The new law says there has to be likelihood of serious bodily harm in the near future. And the words in the near future are what limit how far out you can go. And I mean, I personally, this was the recommendation of the Supreme Court's task force. They had a bunch of law school professors and looked at all 50 states. I still wasn't happy. I actually found the guy whose words those were, and it's a UVA professor, Paul Monahan. He directs the Center for Law and Psychiatry over at UVA. And I asked him, I said, this doesn't seem that much different than what we had. Does the near future, if imminent danger meant in the next 6 hours, which is about what it meant, does this in the near future new words mean a day, a week, 2 weeks, 6 months, 12 months, whatever it means, we ought to decide. And he said the experience in other states has been that they rate how dangerous the person is against the imminence, and that's how they decide. And he said it is a much broader standard. So the first part would be, I'd say it is at least broader than the current standard, and not by a little bit. The larger question is, when can we force someone to get care? Now, the first couple of hearings we had only doctors and family members appear. And so one after the other, they came up to a podium just like this, and they said, my darling son keeps getting in and out of treatment. I can't get him. I can't force him to get care. And then the doctors would come in and say, we keep seeing the same people over and over. We can't force him to get care. And then the husband whose wife was in and out of dozens of times in the hospital. Now, you don't know me in this capacity. I'm a prosecutor. Prosecutors have a lot of involvement with the mental health system. So I'd actually met a lot of people who are mentally ill. Back in law school, I did a thesis on the mentally ill people. I spent time at Western State to interview people. It's not that simple, and here's why. So the third meeting, where I was the chairman, I said, let's make sure we get some actual consumers here to tell us what it's like to use the drugs. Because the obvious answer is we should force people to use the drugs, right? And so then we were able to convince some very brave people who are profoundly mentally ill to tell us why they don't like the drugs. Why should you not simply forcibly treat someone? And they started to tell us about the side effects. You can't sleep. Constant ringing in your ears. Gain over 100 pounds. Significant diabetes. It's called flat affect. Nothing makes you happy. Nothing makes you sad. Kinesia, which is you shake. Their body, their lifespan is much shorter. These are all caused by the drugs. And we had a wonderful lady, and I'd heard similar testimony a decade ago from someone who's bipolar. She said, I'm bipolar. Bipolar means, it used to be called manic depressive. It means wild mood swings. Depressive to the point of suicide. Hypomania, which means everything up and you're happy and you stay up till 4 in the morning and you clean the house. What she said was she takes the drugs to save her life, but nothing makes her happy anymore. Nothing. She says, I used to go from 1 to 10, now I go from 4 to 6. And that's why we need to be careful about these drugs. It's not any more deeper than that. We are forcing someone to get care that they don't want. They say, don't you dare do that to me, and we strap them onto a table and we stick a needle in their arm. And by the way, that drug has these very significant side effects. That's why it's very hard. Western society, Virginia's been dealing with this for 400 years. We used to throw them in a jail, and we didn't like to do that, but we were worried that they would hurt themselves. We have the same worries today. The drugs are a lot better than they used to be, and we're all hoping that in 20 years the drugs will be so much better that we can make it easier. The choices will be easier. If they didn't have these side effects, we would just do it. But with side effects, with trying to let people lead their own lives, that's the reason. Now, let me just say, that is Virginia's approach. There are some states that are much more aggressive about intervening earlier. New York State has something called Kendra's Law. They are fully prepared to intervene year after year after year in an ongoing way and force people to take their meds, even if they're not that dangerous. We might be headed that way, but I think we're not there yet. So those are the balances. If you think we didn't get it right, you're like half the people at all of our hearings. We tried to balance these two concerns and try to get it at the right spot, but certainly there were people that said, you're going too far. I'm not that dangerous yet. You shouldn't be giving me the drugs. And then you had, I don't want to say just doctors, but certainly doctors and family members who say, my son isn't doing what I want him to do. If he would just take his Prozac or his lithium or some of the more serious drugs, everything would work out better. And that was the balance that we tried to reach.
Okay, three more to go.
Okay.
What is re-benchmarking?
Oh, okay. Well, Dave, this is in the education funding arena where we talked about how every locality gives a certain amount of money based on whether they're rich or poor. Well, localities change. And so you might have a power plant move in and suddenly you go from poor to rich. Or your factory might shut down and suddenly, like poor Danville, has gone from relatively well off to very poor. And so every 2 years we do something called re-benchmarking, where we look at all the localities across the state. They've got a very complicated formula and they recalculate what everyone's number is. And so Greene County, to pick an easy example, has been going up because Greene County used to be purely rural. Now if you go to Pretty Creek, if you go to Deer Lake, there's places that have $300,000 and $400,000 homes. That has raised their composite index a little bit. Other places are going down, and so that's what rebenchmarking is. Every 2 years, you have to rebenchmark. Inevitably, it costs the state a lot of money because what happens is everybody is slowly rising, and so every year we rebenchmark and provide. Last year's rebenchmarking meant that we spent another $1 billion to recalculate the numbers and get them right.
This one, when I first read it, I thought that perhaps it really wasn't in your domain, but then I think of the Dillon Rule and Everything's in your domain. Why are not Charlottesville and Albemarle consolidated into one authority?
Well, the short version is that I want to be. They could be. No. There's three different ways you could have Charlottesville. You could have Charlottesville be like Lake Monticello. Lake Monticello is just a spot on the map. In governing terms, it's a great big homeowners association. It has no official capacity. That's one way. The second way is a town like Scottsville. A town has some small, it can have its own police force, it can raise a very small number of taxes. The third way is a city, and Charlottesville is a city, and a city is just like a county. In fact, it's got more powers than a county. So the city of Charlottesville is, in effect, its own little county that just happens to be entirely surrounded by Albemarle County. And at some point in the past, and this is before, I mean, I've been here since 84, but before I got here, they decided, I suppose, they wanted to be their own city. They can, and I forget the term, devolve. I remember a few years ago, they were looking at this real seriously, where they would devolve Charlottesville into a town, or even devolve altogether, and that would end up consolidating the two. If you did that, Albemarle County would be much bigger. You'd add 40,000 people to the rolls. You would consolidate a lot of services. Certainly the schools, fire departments, police would save you some money. I do think you would have some cultural differences between the two approaches. Charlottesville is a city, and they provide an awful lot of services, and they have a lot higher taxes to pay for it. The county has traditionally been just the opposite, with fewer services, lower taxes, and you would have to combine the ice-cold county and the white-hot city into some, I don't know, lukewarm water or something to balance, but that's how they could do it.
I was told, and I do not know if this is true or not, but I was told that there were serious conversations between the city and the county back in the, probably this would have been the 60s, because I came in the 70s, and they got very close to making a deal. And then someone said, what are we going to call it? And it fell apart based on that. Now, that may or may not be true, but that's what I've been told. All right, our last question. There should be a plan for spending transportation funds with priorities set for each approach, i.e. highways, mass transit, park and ride, et cetera, et cetera. Has such a plan been developed? And should taxes be raised before a plan is in place?
Okay, for the last part, I would say not. There is, of course, plans. In other words, VDOT has plans. They give it to the transportation districts. They develop their six-year plan, which you've probably heard of. And the six-year plan is a list that includes every road that they are seriously thinking about. And so it's not quite a wish list, but it's also not, it includes roads that nobody expects to have happen unless we find a gold mine in the state of Virginia. So that is what the local plan is. The state plan is partially dependent on the money we bring in. And so one of the recent concerns, one of the reasons you've read in the paper probably about funding cuts, we are in a recession. And that recession is having impacts on the state revenue, just like it's having, I don't know if we're in a legal recession, but certainly is an economic slowdown, regardless of what economists call it. But that is having impacts on the federal government's revenue, is having impacts on the local government, but right in the middle, it's having impacts on the state. And so the revenue we raise gets into the plan that we have. Now, I suppose we could theoretically wall off part of the budget beyond the Transportation Trust Fund. We could say we're going to take the next penny on the sales tax and use every dollar of that for transportation. We try not to do that any more than we have to. And the reason is, of course, there might be some mental health crisis where we need to use the money for Virginia Tech. It may be that UVA needs the money for capital needs. So to the extent we can, we try and keep at least a large part of the budget flexible through the general fund so we can address year-by-year needs. But the money that goes dedicated in the Transportation Trust Fund, which is car titling tax, gas tax, there's a few other taxes related to transportation, we try to keep that dedicated to transportation funding.
Well, that's it. We've come to the end of the questions. We certainly thank you for your participation and your great answers. And I think we all ought to give each other a round of applause for some good questions. Thank you very much.